Good morning, and welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Brian Field, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. Our speaker today is Garal Perovets. He is the Lionel Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, Department of Government and Politics. He is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge, a founding fellow of Harvard's Institute of Politics, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's also served as a legislative director in the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, and as a special assistant in the Department of State. He's a founding member of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the Board of Directors for the New Economics Institute. Please join me in welcoming Professor Garal Perovets.
Thank you. It's indeed a privilege to be here today and to be in this really august platform where many of my people I admire have spoken before. I want to talk to you about something difficult. That is to say, something for people of different age, including the age of the generation that I represent and some others here. And I want to talk to you about whether or not it is possible to change the system. And my experience is people are very much engaged in doubting that proposition. In fact, most people are quite pessimistic of a progressive audience that anything serious can be done. Ask the person in your seat whether that is so. And they enter with a certain skepticism, certainly on the idea that there could be fundamental change. And more important, they see no particular role other than helping out a bit on the side for themselves. So it becomes not a historical problem, but an existential problem. Now that's a strange, what used to be called for in the 60s, very heavy rap, a challenging question. Is it existential or systemic or both? I'm going to suggest to you that we all have a vested interest in pessimism. It means you don't have to do anything. Nothing can be done. So I'm also going to challenge you at that level to rethink whether you are a person who, like many others of us, share that particular self-protective gown. Enough said for the introduction, speaking from a church pulpit. One way to begin is to ask the question, how could you tell a systemic problem from a garden variety political problem? Well, one way, and I suggest this is the easiest way to enter the problem, is to look at long trends that don't change but get worse over time, no matter who you elect. Means something deeper is creating the trends at a different level of what we call the system. So, for instance, over the last 30 years, as many know, the top 1% has increased its share of income from 10% to 20 or 22, depending upon the year, and the bottom 99% has lost that share for 30 years, minimally. Doesn't much matter. George Bush was in office. We have Democrats, Republicans. Obama's in office. Doesn't change. Gets worse. CO2 production, for those of you interested in climate change, has gone up 30%. Pretty steadily, give or take, since 1970. You find the same in many other areas. I could give you many. My book carries a whole listing of these that, by and large, don't much change. One that you probably haven't thought about, most people don't, particularly people who are not of a different color. And if you're interested in liberty, this is the best test of liberty, how many people actually lose their liberty. We could get into civil rights legislation, et cetera, but who loses their liberty? Over the last 30 years, we have gone from about 90 people per 100,000 to about 750 per 100,000 on a pretty steady increase in the number of people who have gone to prison and jail, mostly black and brown. We are 8 times the number per capita now imprisoned than any other advanced country, including Russia. Something is going on that's producing the trends. So I won't burden you with more on this subject, but I ask you to think, and we can spend more time on it in the question period. If that is the case, if there's something driving it, then either there is a systemic solution, whatever that might mean, or there's not a solution. Now, I say all this reminding you, just briefly, that I've come out of, used to manage House and Senate staffs. I've been in real politics. Some of you environmentalists may remember the name Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. I was his legislative director. I come out of the real world of politics. So when I suggest that we face a systemic problem, it isn't simply an academic judgment. It's a judgment of someone who's been there, done that, if you like. It could be wrong, but it is a judgment out of that era. Now, if that's so, what do we mean by a systemic crisis? Mostly historians, and I wear two hats, historian and political economist, mostly historians identify the ownership of property as the central, not the only, but the central element in defining any system. That's where the power comes from. So, to make it simple, in medieval times, land, being the most important form of wealth, gave power to the lords, the church, and the king, but not to the peasants and not to the serfs. In the Soviet Union, the ownership by the state of wealth gave power to the state bureaucrats in a very discouraging and reprehensible way. In the mid-19th century capitalism in America, 19th century, what you found was small farmers, largely small farm business people, not serfs as in feudal country. They were in the capitalist market, and you had a sort of picture of free enterprise capitalism, largely, not entirely farmers, but farmers with a dominant role by far, business people. We live in the era of corporate capitalism. The corporations dominate and their owners dominate. You may not be aware of the concentrations here, but let me give you how powerful this system is concentrated at the top. The top 400 people, just think about that, you could easily get them in this church, have more wealth than the bottom 180 million Americans taken together. 400 people. Possibly, they and the corporations they largely own might be seen as the centerpiece of modern power in the state. And certainly that, many studies indicate, is true. But we are not often aware of how concentrated power really is in this particular corporate capitalism. It is extreme. I once said in a lecture like this, in fact, it's medieval in nature, that concentration of power in the system in which we live. But I said it was medieval, and a medieval historian came up to me afterward and he said, never was that concentrated in medieval times. And he was right. He was right. The concentration wasn't that extreme when you actually study the numbers. So we live in that system, and it was for a while, and I think here is where pessimism from amongst liberals and progressives comes from, and I come out of that tradition, working for congressmen and liberal senators and congressmen. Pessimism is there was a moment when we all thought there was a way to reform the system and bend the trends. The 60s, even the 70s, particularly for the environmental movement. The war on poverty, health care, the great changes of Medicare, all of those things happened and were progressive. And indeed, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, many other changes in the environmental sphere. And something has changed. Trends are going the wrong direction, long trends. And I want to suggest to you why that's so and why it forces us all, if we're willing, to confront the fact that there's a system question and that we need to find a way to deal with it. Very simply, and this has been studied by political scientists, political economists worldwide, the way in which the corporate system has traditionally been balanced. John Kenneth Galbraith, who I gather spoke from this podium, is a good friend of mine, had the phrase countervailing power. You could countervail, reform, tax, regulate. That's what most people probably in this room were brought up to think was the way forward. That system of allowing the wealth to be concentrated and the corporate power to exist, that system was countervailed all over the world by political institutions and political strategies that at bottom depended upon another institution. The name of the game is institutional power. That institution was and still is in much less power, the traditional labor unions. They fueled politics of social democracy in Europe and liberalism here. Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day, one of the leading environmental senators in 20th century history, was a labor lawyer. He could not have gotten elected without support from labor. And what has happened in the change in the architecture of the system, all too simply, is that American labor unions, never powerful, in Sweden there were 85% of the labor force were members, at our peak we were 34.5 in 1953, has trended down to a mere 11% of the labor force now in unions, a little over 6% in the private sector, and decaying. So what you've got, think about this, is a corporate power system, once somewhat countervailed, nothing like Sweden, nothing like most of the European countries where the social programs and environmental programs in many areas were much better, once was countervailed, is no longer countervailed, and the power structure that attends large wealth and corporate ownership is more and more free of restriction to do what it wants. It is not an evil system. It is a system that wants to grow, that is in competition worldwide, but has destructive implications. It has to cut costs, which means it wants to reduce wages. It has to concentrate power. It must end environmental regulations because it's in competition. And it is a system that is producing, all too simply, is producing the trends that we are aware of. And the old way of dealing with it is fading away before our eyes. So if you believed in the old way, I come out of that tradition, you must be pessimistic. Unless you think history is a bit bigger than that, and that there may be other ways at other times, and that people have faced difficult challenges that are systemic in nature also at other times, and maybe possibly if we stand back, there may be a different way forward. There's a big series of maybes in that set of propositions. But I ask you, to allow yourself to think maybe there is a different way to change the system than the one we were brought up with, and that maybe we have something to do in the matter rather than to ponder. That's the hard place existentially. Who? Me? Us? Who else? So, let me suggest something that's going on which the press doesn't cover and which has been very important and very interesting and is happening in many parts of the country, and may presage the possible buildup of long-term power to transform something called the system. Another series of maybes. But the way to handle what I'm going to talk about, I think, most easily intellectually, is to place yourself, for the moment, in 1915 in the United States, where experiments were developing in the so-called laboratories of democracy. I'm from Wisconsin. There was a lot of labor law experimentation. What became Social Security was developed at the state level. Many, many programs were started out at the state and local level that looked to be interesting experiments that at the right moment built up over time to become enlarged the basic elements of the New Deal. But they looked like experiments. Or if you like another way to think about it, place yourself in 1870. When the women's movement was all but modestly winning a few states against huge odds, and over time slowly built up and became the basis of transforming the vote for women. over time, starting out with small city and state experiments, state by state by state by state, agonizingly. Or if you like, put yourself, given that we're here in this wonderful part of the country, maybe 1745, and think about those mostly farmers, and a few small merchants who thought they could take on the biggest empire in the history of the world. Crazy idea to challenge that system, and they won. So with that, by way of suggestion that we may be in something roughly analogous, if we allowed ourselves to imagine it, what is happening that the press isn't covering, and what I think is of some significance, is that all over the country there are experiments building up that are literally transforming and democratizing the ownership of wealth in practical terms throughout the United States, not covered by the newspapers. Partly, newspapers are owned by conservatives mostly, and so they don't cover this. Mostly, they are in very great financial difficulty, so they don't have staff to cover local events. But here's some of what you'll find. You'll find it in my book, and I'm going to give you one website which covers this, www.community-wealth.org. Put the dash in, community-wealth covers what I'm going to talk about. So the most obvious democratized form of wealth at the local level is the garden variety cooperative. Most people don't know the 130 million Americans are members of co-ops. Odd. Now, a good part of that is the garden variety credit union. All the credit unions together are democratic banks. They have as much capital as any, taken together, as any one of the big New York banks. Moreover, this very odd and old institution is becoming challenged by reformers. Mostly, the credit unions do quite ordinary things. They finance autos and housing, but they can finance co-ops and other developments, and they are democratic institutions. Nobody ever goes to the annual meeting because they're so boring, except some activists have realized that if they could go to the annual meeting, they're probably in a majority and they could elect the board and shift the priorities of a very traditional socialist institution. Whoa, I used the word socialism. It is a democratized bank all over the United States, very conventional, but also very much open to what I'm talking about. You probably didn't know also, as most people don't, that there are 10,000 worker-owned companies in the United States, that 3 million more people are involved today than are members of unions in the private sector, and they are growing. I happened to do a piece in the New York Times Saturday, some of you may have seen, on the baby boom is retiring, and baby boom owners of new businesses are finding that there are tax advantages to sell to their workers. So there could be a huge transfer because of the retirement possibility to worker ownership. Another democratized ownership effort in the country that most people don't know about, worker ownership of the means of production. There it is in America. 10 million people, 3 million more than are members of labor unions, already out there and expanding. In many cities around the country, another form of democratized ownership is building up. The traditional municipal ownership schemes. 25%, now I use the word technically, 25% of American electricity generation is already socialized, municipal, electric, and co-ops. And by that I mean owned by not just co-ops, but by government institution, municipality. That's expanding. Again, without much press. Still another one. Land ownership in the public interest, democratizing it, is now become an explosive development around the country. It's called a land trust. Somewhere around here in Vermont and in western Massachusetts 30 years ago, they were experimenting with public land trusts, not just conservation trusts, that's a different form, but to build up housing, to preserve the land, to do agricultural development, to change ownership of property in the land area and in cities to prevent gentrification. Draw a circle around a large neighborhood, put it under nonprofit or city control. You can control the land prices and the gentrification process. You can tap into the capital gains in one part of it to subsidize another part of it because you own the capital, the land. That was an idea way off the charts 30 years ago. Now it is all over the country because it's the only way to solve some local problems. Irvine, California is doing 5,000 units of land trust housing. And many other cities probably not reported to you because these things aren't reported on much unless you actually dig in. So another form of ownership, let me give you a sharp example. It's partly because you can't solve problems without doing something new. And my contention is, and if I had time to elaborate on it, largely it's because of the failing of the old system to solve problems, pain is growing, and either the pain continues and continues, or you have to innovate. So I'll give you two examples of what's happening, not simply in numbers. I could go on in the book, I cover a lot more of these things that are going on that all have this characteristic that instead of trying to regulate or tax the old countervailing position that I was brought up with, directly changing ownership, and in a very, very American down-home decentralized way, co-ops, land trusts, municipalities, credit unions, worker-owned companies. Most people don't know about that one, but there it is out there. Very, very decentralized. This is not statism, but it is changing ownership in a particularly American culture. So let me give you a couple examples of how the advance is not only in numbers, but in sophistication as the pain levels grow and as people don't see the old option and either do nothing or innovate in a new direction. I was involved with steelworkers in 1977 in the state of Ohio, Youngstown. Major steel mill went down, one of the first ones. Some may remember it. At those days when 5,000 people lost their jobs, it was front page news. Not anymore. It happens so often. The steelworkers and the local religious leaders in Youngstown came up with the idea, why don't we own and redevelop and modernize this mill? Why not? Seemed like a crazy idea, but they were serious. They got the support of all the state politicians. They got the national religious movement. They did their politics. They brought up enough pressure to the Carter administration to actually finance a study by top steel experts. It could be done. And then to promise $200 million in loan guarantees. It could be done. Amazing. It was a very exciting move around the country. And not surprisingly, after the election of 1978, the money disappeared and it was rumored, probably true, that the big corporations got to the Carter administration, and so did the big steel unions. The steel union, not the locals, the national, international, was violently against it publicly. We just do trade union, we don't do worker ownership. People in Youngstown, and the religious leaders in particular, lots of folks our age, knew that they had to do their politics and spread the word and begin to educate people. So they understood they might lose the battle, but maybe they might fight on for the war. And they built up around particularly many parts of the country, but in the state of Ohio in particular, the idea that worker ownership is a good idea, particularly in the Rust Belt, where the declining pain was so great. So now you find, that's why I gave you a 30-year time horizon, end of the 19th century, the 30 years before the New Deal, the 30 years before the success of the ladies and women's movement, etc. Now you find in the state of Ohio perhaps more worker-owned companies per capita, nobody knows for sure, the counts aren't very good, than any place else in the country. So did they win or did they lose? And the idea is there, and if you go to the city of Cleveland, an advance and much more sophistication has taken place, so that in the poorest part of Cleveland, this is a neighborhood of 40,000 people, black almost entirely, 40% unemployment, family income 18,000. You get it. You will find a sophisticated array of advanced scale worker-owned companies linked together with a nonprofit corporation, so it isn't just about the companies making money for themselves and their workers, but putting back into the whole community, linked with a revolving fund so that you're making money from the some of the worker-owned companies to finance new ones in an expanding way. And at scale, the largest urban greenhouse in the United States was just opened 3 months ago under worker ownership. All of it very green. The most sophisticated, one of the most sophisticated green laundries in the country is there, in a platinum LEED building, partly under worker ownership. And you'll find a solar installation company, et cetera, in a very sophisticated elaboration and extension of the model that was seemingly lost in Youngstown. And now 10 other cities around the country are doing something similar, and 100 more are trying to, and you find an elaboration of the scheme. And most interestingly, for those of you who care about the environment, they're trying to stabilize the market so that they don't really have to expand. Expansion often comes in conflict with the environment. But of necessity, most companies fearing competition must expand. That's the name of the game. Otherwise, you lose. So in the middle of that neighborhood, and in many other parts of the country, we could talk about it in question period, are huge quasi-public institutions, quasi-public meaning nonprofit hospitals and universities, quasi-public because they have Medicare, Medicaid, lots of taxpayer dollars, and lots of taxpayer education dollars. In this poor neighborhood I've just described for you, those three institutions, the Cleveland Clinic, a renowned global, worldwide institution, University Hospital, Case Western Reserve University, right in the middle of this poor neighborhood, they purchase $3 billion in goods and services a year, with a B, not an M. None of it previously from this neighborhood. So now there is an effort to begin to focus, a successful effort, some of that purchasing power to stabilize and rebuild the community as a way both to do it and to do it in a green way under different ownership in Cleveland, Ohio, and in many other communities. Now that's a very interesting development because that's a small, for those of you watching closely, that is a small-scale systemic design. It's not just worker ownership floating in the sea of competition. It is worker ownership building a community, something along the Mondragon lines for the big Basque co-ops are part of this design. Some of you may know about the large 85,000-person cooperative successful in the Basque country. It's been an inspiration for some of this. But also, going beyond that, to build geographic community and to stabilize it, using purchasing power from quasi-public institutions. Driven by necessity and pain, you either innovate or you don't, and the decay continues. That's the lesson of all this. I'll give you one more example and then go on, given the time. I mentioned land trusts, which is a way to get public democratized ownership around the country that most people don't know about, and how it's spreading around the country. Typically, in a city like Washington, D.C., and many other cities, if there's a big public investment in, say, mass transit rails, at every exit, land values would go up because of housing costs. It's a good place to live because stores want to be there. And the developers want that land. And then the city runs after them, timidly trying to tax back some of the money. Not anymore. Now, in many cities around the country, the land is essentially socialized. That is to say, a land trust in which the profits from this process of public investment, in transportation in this case, are captured directly for public use. Washington, D.C. is one of those cities. And that's happening around the country because you need money and the tax base is not there and the old system isn't working. I could go on, and I won't, except to say that there are three other things that need to be noted. These are all local developments under the radar. In many states, people see clearly that much larger institutions are also beginning to be transformed if you think about the prehistory of the next great change, the 30 years before. If you look at healthcare, as you know, we waste $1 trillion a year on healthcare. Waste? By comparison with most other advanced systems, if we shared about half as much of the percentage of the GDP as Norway, Sweden, France, Britain, Canada, roughly half, we would save $1 trillion with better healthcare. Our outcomes in healthcare are worse than all of the advanced systems, and we paid almost twice as much for it. The cost problems are impending even with Obamacare. And almost certainly, in my view, and I try to develop this in my book, but many others have pointed to it, the trajectory used to be reformed by regulation, but the power behind regulation is not sufficient, so we're going to see a lot of pain and anger and pain and anger and pain and anger, and the trajectory is almost certainly to single-payer, state by agonizing state by agonizing state in a very painful way because there is no real alternative way available. Again, a long discussion. Vermont is going to do it in 2014. California passed it twice. It was vetoed by Schwarzenegger. Many other states will see this process. if that process continues, it isn't only small-scale local development of the kind I'm talking about. That's 18% of the economy, maybe 20% shortly. A fifth of the United States economy over time may move towards a democratized ownership. Medicare is the form we know about. Medicare is a publicly owned democratized insurance company. That's all it is. So a single-payer democratized insurance company, slowly displacing the existing ones. One other, if you look closely at the banking industry, most experts, left, right, and center, predict major crises in the banking sector because you can't regulate the big guys. They are too powerful, which means there will be more financial crises. And as the crises deepen, two things are already beginning to happen. The first is the beginning of a buildup. Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, is pointing towards break up the big banks at the next round because you can't regulate them. They're too powerful. But anybody who studied the history of AT&T or Standard Oil knows that when you break them up, the big fish eat the little fish, and you come right back to the same place. I think the traditional conservatives, as you've noticed, I've given you an entirely conservative argument so far, I think the traditional conservative argument about this was dead on, and I think it's likely to be right. And it's this. This is from the founders of the Chicago School of Economics, Henry C. Simons, the founder, and Milton Friedman, the great conservative economist, great teacher, much lauded teacher, much admired teacher, made this argument along with many other traditional conservatives who were interested in free market economics. They didn't believe in regulation. They pointed out, if you can't regulate them, too big to regulate, they will control the regulators, and if you break them up, they will regroup. There's only one thing left to do. Conservatives, not socialists, turn them into public utilities. That was their argument, and I think we're likely to see some of that happening down the line. We already do have ownership of AIG, the largest insurance company in the world, as a public utility, probably going to be sold back. We did, in fact, have the capacity in the last round, because we owned so much money, we had loaned them and bought stock so much money, that big banks were, in fact, de facto public utilities, so we sold them back after subsidy. I think that's going to play itself out. Over the next decades, some of them will be turned into public utilities because there ain't no alternative. Not because of some socialist ideology, but because you can't do it any other way. That's one trajectory. Those of you may have noticed there's also a whole trajectory of what's called public banking developing around the country. Public banking. Again, not reported on by the newspapers. The state of North Dakota, a very conservative state, has had for 90 years a state-owned public bank, socialist bank, supported by all the small businessmen, the farmers, the co-op people, and the broad public as a very successful bank, makes money for the taxpayers, and is very, very popular. 20 states have introduced legislation now to set up banks like the state of North Dakota. And if you have a perspective that we may be in the prehistory of the next great change, I believe we're going to see more of that as the banking crisis deepens. So now I'm giving you kind of a panoply. Some things bubbling up you probably haven't been noticed because the press doesn't cover it. They all change the ownership of wealth in a way that is democratized, very American in its tradition, localist, state, but also a certain difference from trying to regulate them and letting the corporations and the elites own the wealth. Highly different vision. And one last one. I don't know if you noticed, but we nationalized two of the biggest corporations in America, Chrysler and General Motors, when the crisis came. So we shall see down the line where the big, big, big corporations fit in all of this and whether they may be turned in some cases to public utilities or not. It's very, very common around the world. We are one of the few countries that doesn't do that regularly. But in most countries, I list all the countries where the oil companies, that's another question, air companies that are owned, there are all sorts of land developments, you name it, everything, telecommunications. Around the world, there has been a revolution in public ownership and modernization and efficiency. So I'm painting for you the picture that just possibly, because of the failings of the existing trajectory, just possibly we are in the prehistory of an extremely American, very decentralized, highly democratized, laying out of the idea that the ownership and control of wealth ought to be democratized, but not in the old statist forms, but in something practical that you can do locally in a city like Cleveland or here. You probably do have, in many instances, land trusts around, if you look closely, and co-ops and all. And that this movement has a possibility because the pain levels are deepening in those long trends. If people, this is the next step, and why we get into the act, unless we prefer pessimism, because we don't have to act. It may be important to use the skills that are developed particularly by older people as well as younger people to actually develop this movement in a sophisticated, modern, high-powered, intelligent way that draws on the knowledge and skills of older people as well as younger people, building forward over time with the idea that minimally this is a positive development. And just possibly we may see ourselves as historically potentially laying the groundwork for the next American system. Hard stuff. I'm a historian. Quote, revolutions, whatever that may mean, some are peaceful, some are evolutionary, some are violent, are as common as grass in world history. Look what's happening in the Middle East. Nobody predicted it. Nobody predicted the most important modern cultural revolution in modern times, the women's movement. Nobody predicted the civil rights movement as explosion. I'm from Wisconsin. I was living in Wisconsin in the 1950s. Joe McCarthy dominated everything, not nationally, but in Wisconsin, where he was from. If you had predicted possibility of change in the 1950s in Wisconsin, you would have been regarded as certifiable. And then the 1960s exploded. That is not a claim that it is inevitable that change will occur. It is simply a challenge to the conventional and quite comforting myth that nothing can be done, and footnote, I don't have to do anything. So it's a challenge to whether or not we are listening to the possibilities that might be emerging. Now, of course, it's all positive in any case, so it's useful to do the kinds of things that are being done. And if those of you who are involved in the environmental or ecological movement, there is a converging tendency and trend, not yet reaching to this point, it's called the New Economy Movement, beginning to realize that traditional environmental efforts now need to talk about the system and systemic change too. And the convergence of concerns with ecological sustainability, with the rebuilding of an ecologically coherent community vision, also center on democratizing the power base. If you don't control that, usually you lose. That's the problem, and the old system is gone. So there's a beginning understanding that some of what I've been talking about here is beginning to permeate also the ecological movements around the country. So I'm a historian and a political economist. Not naive, I've run House and Senate staffs and been a high government official in planning policy in the State Department. Been there, done that. My cool assessment is that minimally, there is an extraordinary amount that can be done and is being done. Maximally, it is possible, we shall see, that we are laying the foundations, not maximally, to simply bolster the old countervailing system. And maximally, that we are actually in the process of developing the ingredients, the ideas, the inspiration, the way forward that may be laying the foundations for a very American new system, different from the old models of corporate capitalism, state socialism, something truly American. It would be fitting for this people to do that work. Thank you.
This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers are collecting them, let me ask the first question, because I'm in charge and I can. So Can you speak to the correlation between worker-owned businesses and environmental ethics? Specifically, why do worker-owned businesses seem to hold themselves to a higher environmental ethic? And can you share some examples?
They don't necessarily. So it's important to understand that. Worker-owned companies operating, this is one of the, well, there's a whole part of this it's important to note. There's a theoretical debate going on of high sophistication about all of this. Worker-owned companies operating in a market sea of competitiveness are forced to cut costs just like anybody else because if you don't, they will. That's what's interesting about this Cleveland model, where you are giving sufficient stability to the model so that you can include costs that are not that are additional costs, but you're providing for the environment as well. One other aspect of this, however, does cut across this. It's very interesting. What we've learned is that people now want to buy from firms that are environmentally conscious and successful. So worker-owned companies, many of them, are beginning to see that the only way they can survive is also to provide to high standards of ecological production. So there's a balancing act going on, but the real solution is providing greater stability so that not only do they not have to pollute, but they don't have to grow and fight against the limits that we now face, both ecologically in terms of climate change. Very interesting, complex development going on around the country in just this issue as people fight it out and work out the theoretical as well as practical aspects.
Thank you. Question from our audience. As we saw in 2010 midterm election and its aftermath, small groups of self-interested people can organize to take over the public square and can also be manipulated by the Koch brothers and so on. What's to stop that? What's the difference between that takeover and the current control by the 1%?
Well, that is an extreme version of the 1%. In many cases, perhaps moving towards an anti-democratic politics, as we've seen, financing ways to exclude people from the polls and from voting. There is a big fight building up in this country. So partly, and certainly the winning hand currently where the big money is not the hand I've just talked about. And I also suggested, as I think, times may get worse before they get better. But it is also the case that those with great power don't always win. That's the nature of revolutions, because they don't solve the problems that hurt millions and millions and millions of people. So I am no determinist, including the determinism that those with the money must always win. I'm suggesting to you that the situation may be open. We shall see, because people power can build, we know that historically, but doesn't necessarily have to. We shall see it. The balance is with us, not them.
If the change in ownership is inevitable, then why should an individual take any action at all? I'm 74. This is the writer, not me. The system does well by me. Why should I risk anything for the sake of inevitable change?
I did not say inevitable change. I'm not an inevitabilist. If I were an inevitabilist, I wouldn't be lecturing or writing or thinking or acting. I think many situations in history are open to human intervention. Not all, but many. And it is possible, given the context as it is emerging, you know, there are many possibilities. One is that the decay continues. More decay, more decay, more decay, more decay, more ecological, that is a possibility. It's possible that there will be a takeover by the extreme right wing, a loss of civil liberties, and something like corporate fascism. If there's any violence in this country, you will see extreme crackdown, whoever's in power. We're already seeing some of that. But it is also possible, if you look at the historical basis of great transformations, that people actually can take over and transform the possibilities they face. You pays your money and you, it gets what you get. It leaves the role for the individual open, and certainly doing nothing is to guarantee failure. We shall see.
The next question is, so what happened to organized labor?
What happened and why did it decline? Huge subject of academic debate. Some say globalization, which certainly was part of it. Some say that there's been a challenge by the labor unions themselves not being active enough. Certainly, corporate power mounted a huge attack beginning in the early 70s with the Ronald Reagan clamping down on the air controllers and corporate attack. But mostly, and this is hard for my friends in the labor movement to face, labor unions in the United States have always been very, very, very weak compared with other countries. And it is probably an aberration that they ever got to the strength they had. They were only 11% in 1929. The Depression got them up to 26% because there was a great crisis. World War II expanded them to 35%. And as those conditions decayed, in my view, they inevitably returned to a weak norm. That's not certain. Nobody can prove that. But I think that's even more important than the fact that cheap Chinese goods began to undercut labor, which they certainly have.
Thank you. As a retired CEO of a $1 billion company, I wonder about the practicality of what you speak of. The longer I'm retired, I question more and more. But corporations are not democracies.
Well, that's very interesting. Let me respond to that. And that's why I mentioned the Mondragon Corporation in the Basque country of Spain. It's very popular. How many know of Mondragon? The number here. It is extremely, the word is spreading around about Mondragon now. It's 85,000 people. Successfully competes in many international markets at the highest level and wins. And it is democratized in ownership and control, participatory democracy throughout. The wage levels in 85%, it's 85 co-ops in an integrated larger co-op. In 85% of them, the wage levels top to bottom are 6-1. Most big corporations, it's 200-300-1. In part of it, where the larger ones competing in bigger markets, there is a slightly different ratio. 9-1 is the max. And they are winning in competition with major corporations, in part because of the cooperative and voluntary and kind of independent bring ideas up from the bottom spirit, and partly because of the energy and feeling that people know they're part of a community, they won't be laid off. When there is a big layoff, they share the work instead of firing people. So there's a different spirit that produces productivity gains. So we shall see whether or not the Mondragon examples that begin to multiply as people around the country build them can take on some of the big corporations. By no means a closed case, and certainly if Mondragon's an example, maybe a winning case for cooperative production.
What's the skill set that the worker owners need as they engage in systems change? Do they know how to govern?
Worker ownership is not successful, as you might imagine, without adequate training. So anyone who has been involved in this field for a long time, and there are many practitioners, one of the things that's happened over 35 years, I mentioned the development of innovation, the development of numbers, and so forth, there are now experts who didn't exist 35 years ago, another piece of the historical change. One of the things that is quite clear, big studies on this, that without adequate training and participation, worker-owned companies are no better, and sometimes worse, than others. However, and this has also been a field of big study for the last 25 years, worker-owned companies with adequate training into self-government outperform comparable companies in the same field in virtually all the studies. Greater productivity, greater job security, greater penetration of markets on almost every level. When there's adequate training and self-management, they win on almost every level.
Please comment on the rulings by the Supreme Court, particularly in the last session, that are very pro-corporate, limited class action suits.
The answer is yes, they are. and indeed, the court stands as this particular Supreme Court stands against this particular line of development. However, there's another side of this that's interesting. In the piece that I just published in the Times, many, many genuine conservatives, and I use that term in a funny way, I mean people who care start at the bottom and care about individualism and individual work and the work ethic and owning, are supportive of worker-owned companies. Ronald Reagan was a supporter of worker-owned companies. You find many conservatives in the cities that I've been talking about. What they see is people want to work hard, they want to learn, they want to owning, and they're trying to build community, and they're also helping the local market by creating more jobs and more buyers in the local market. When you get beyond the national ideologues on the radio and the politicians and go to the local levels in trouble, and you have something that is practical and real, you find very interesting. People call themselves conservatives, call themselves liberal, call themselves radical, but on these grounds they often find common ground to work together.
What about the military-industrial complex and the privatization that's been going on that increases contractors? If a military contractor were worker-owned, would they vote for the extinction of their trade?
Would a worker-owned company vote for the extinction of its trade? Well, first part of it is, yes, there is concentration of ownership in the military area. But here's something most people don't know. Military spending in the United States, though high absolutely, is declining radically as a share of the economy. We are now, during the 1940s, during 1953 was the peak. During the Korean War, it was 14% of the economy. About 10% average in the 50s, about 8% in the 60s. It is now at 3.3% of the economy level and declining as a share of this large economy. So in a funny way, over time, and I suggested we're looking at long periods of time, I think Americans in general are getting tired of sending people to die. There seems to be a reaction to that. And the cost figures show the decline. So we may actually see, not a phase out, but a radical decline in the power of that system. I hope that's true. It may leave more openings for other things to be built, but it is not inevitable that the military-industrial complex will control the economic system.
If these experimental institutions do grow, what do you think will happen to the traditional countervailing institutions, the Senate, the Congress, etc., over time? Will they become irrelevant?
Well, I think there's two different aspects here. The underlying institutional base, what we've been talking about, the economic and other institutions at the base, I mentioned some 20 states and banking systems are beginning to be talked about. Whether that goes in a powerful way, we shall see. But there is another problem at the level of political institutions, which you may have noticed, that the Congress itself is in very great stalemate. Political theorists who I talk to and political scientists are just beginning to realize that this wonderful 18th century contraption is a very odd and it was designed to prevent certain people, it was designed to preserve conservative power of the people who were trying to do it. It is a very interesting design, but it was not designed for reform. It was designed for checks and balances to hold things back. The great Madison was explicit in Federalist Number 10 that the problem that had to be addressed was the people with property could be taken over by the people without property, and you needed a systemic design. Read like Karl Marx. It's very amazing to read Federalist 10. You had to set up a system that wouldn't allow the masses to take over, and besides, you had to preserve slavery. That was the deal. It is a very conservative design. And my suspicion is we're going to see over this century, a whole reassessment of that constitutional structure. To say nothing of, and here this gets very interesting indeed, it's a debate that started in the 30s, it was preempted by World War II. This is a huge country. I say it in that way because people don't quite face the scale. Sometimes I tell my students, you know, it's so gigantic, it doesn't even come in the same register with dinky little countries like the European countries. Dinky little? That's just to catch their attention. You can drop Germany into Montana. You can organize politics and a polity in small countries. The continent is gigantic. It's now at 318 million, moving to 500 million. If you buy the high option of the Census Bureau, they project 1.1 billion. It is all but impossible to govern such a thing at the national continental level. Almost certainly breakups of some kind, not breakups, I mean different power organizations are likely. And most states are too small. The continent's too big. The center of attention is likely, therefore, to be the intermediate region, a unit called a region. And New England is one of the most interesting places where regional development, in my view, is likely to take place. You've already experimenting in a number of areas, climate areas and agricultural areas, energy areas. New England and the far northwest experimenting with regional designs that may also be part of this larger, longer-term picture.
Okay, last question. You say the press isn't doing its job. How can we get them to do their job?
I don't think the press can do this job for a long time because the press is under severe pressure. However, there is the internet and lots of people reporting on the internet. And that webpage I mentioned, www.community-wealth.org, is only one of myriad reporting institutions that tell you what's out there if you want to find out. The problem is no longer with the institutions. It lies with us and our willingness just to dig a little bit more and actually to do something. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you again, Professor Alperovitz, for sharing your time and expertise today. You certainly turned me from a pessimist. You've sowed the seeds of optimism. You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org or by writing the Monadnock Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program next Sunday will feature Margot Adler, who will be speaking about vampires, morality, and the fate of the planet. Thank you, Professor Alperovitz, for the interesting examination of a possible future economic system.